Okay, what we've been looking at, first of all, the images we've been looking at are from one of the problems we have sometimes. I think we talk about Celtic tradition, we talk about the ancestral traditions of these islands, and what's commonly thought of as Celtic tradition are the Welsh and Irish medieval texts that look back in that direction, but mostly come from the very earliest of them comes from about the 12th century. But when we start when we look at the earliest Brythonic people of these lands, when we start to look at what's really, you know, what has been called Celtic, we're looking at a culture, really. We're looking at the things that the images I showed you from the Hallstatt and the Latin cultures, so called because the artifacts around those cultures were found in the town of Hallstatt and also in France, the place of Latin. So Switzerland, France, pretty much. There's been some great artistic discoveries there, and because they were some of the first discoveries, they gave the name to that to the kind of culture that then arises out of this. But the Celts, or what we call the Celts, or that Celtic culture, is probably more accurately, it comes right across Europe, Turkey, Eastern Europe, right across Europe and eventually into Britain and Ireland. Now, what we think of as Celtic now is what happens to the Brythonic peoples as a result of the kind of later invasions of the Saxons, the Danes, the Norman French. So what happens is something complicated happens in that actually there is enormous integration of peoples, but political organization of the kind of Brythonic peoples means that the defined Brythonic kingdoms are pushed out to the edges of Britain. So Cornwall, Wales, Scotland, Ireland, of course, doesn't get, you know, maintains its own place of integrity, really. But we have to start, if we're thinking about the kind of world soul, the soul of the, or the kind of soul of the country, we have to start at that very early place, at the Brythonic place. The kind of territory that we've just been looking at these artifacts, of which we have no writing at all. So when we look at things like Druid, one of the things that we do know because of Roman writings, well, actually only because of Roman writings, is there were these figures called Druids. And Druids were, and so there was a sort of, one of the things that did exist in that pre-Roman time, which links into the cultural integrity of the kind of images that we've been looking at, is it appears that there was a religious philosophical system that spanned across tribes, that was cultural rather than bloodline and history. Because we have these figures called Druids who are found in Europe, found in Britain, to a certain extent, but lesser extent, found in Ireland. What we know of these figures really is that they are figures that are connected with the connection between human beings and the other world. And that they had a very particular kind of status. They were sort of outside normal life, but they had a kind of authority that wasn't political, but in some senses even superseded political authority. So we get instances of druids walking onto battlefields and everything having to stop in the middle of a battle because a druid is there. Now, most of what we know about druidry comes really from sort of 18th century. It also comes from the writings of Iolo Morgannwg, but we get a whole kind of sort of a rediscovery of the image of the druid.
Sorry, missed you there. Any pickup?
So in the late 17th century and 18th century, we get the rediscovery of the image of the druid. We find it in Blake. Because what starts to happen, and one of the reasons why people get interested in druidry, is that as industrialization happens, as the evils of industrialization, this is in a sense what Blake is using the image of the druid and the image of Albion to bring attention to, is that the idea is that we are losing contact with a particular way of being with and thinking about the world, which is represented in those kind of images those images of connection, of flow, of vegetation, of life, of growth. And that the need is somehow to bring these ideas back. Now, the ideas don't vanish entirely, but the idea of the druid does, and that gets renewed. And as I say, in the 17th and 18th century, and in particular, we have Iolo Morgannwg writes various things, but particularly a text called Bardas, which he says are the teachings of the ancient bards, that were the teachings of the ancient druids. And out of that kind of 18th century synthesis, a new druidic order gets set up, which is now the Welsh Gorsedd, which has this threefold, has a whole kind of threefold arrangement of bards, ovits, and druids, and has a whole kind of structure put on top of it, which has ancient roots. The idea of the triplicity in it, you can find way back, right back in these very, very kind of early images, and you find them also in a lot of medieval things. But of course, it's a rewritten, recreated druidry. Now, Iolo Morgannwg is an interesting and fascinating figure in some ways, but he wasn't shy about making stuff up and trusting his intuition over anything factual. And it, in a certain sense, what that gives to things like Bardas is it makes it into too much of a system. So you get the three circles of the universe. You get your threefold division, and that becomes a sort of almost dogma, rather than a principle of working with opposites and allowing the third thing to happen. He creates a whole slightly bureaucratic inner world based on triplicities. There's nothing wrong in that, except that it has some of the restrictive elements of modern thinking that would be different from that much more fluidic thing that happens when we just engage with the ancient images. Something similar happens actually to Robert Graves. Robert Graves wrote this extraordinary, beautiful book about poetry and about poetic consciousness called The White Goddess. And, 50, 60 years down the line, that's now become a textbook of dogmatic pagan religion. And the problem that it has, in a sense, is that you've lost the heart of it. And there's a certain way, when you pick up some of the 18th century druidic stuff, you can very easily lose the heart of it, out of the desire to understand. because the thing above all, when we start to think about the roots of kind of religious tradition in Britain, is that we have these things called Druids. They come out of Latin, they come out of the Hallstatt culture. There is a, you can see, if we look at, as British and Welsh culture develops, you can see lines of descent within it. But you can't say anything very accurate, or you, at all, about what Druids actually did or practiced or thought. You can only infer. You know, we've got the descriptions of the mistletoe cutting, the descriptions of the grove that the Druids practiced. They're beautiful. You can work with those images and be interested in them. And I've used some of those images in the paper that I've sent you. And certainly I've found a lot of benefit from working with those images. But we cannot in any way say, well, of course, that's what they did. And in a certain sense, I suppose it doesn't matter, I think. In fact, in some ways, there's something quite nice about having this mysterious source that leaves us these hints behind. But we have to really deal with our capacity, our desire, to have everything concrete in ways that we can understand and pin down. Now, one of the places where we do get some sense, really, of where, of what Romano-Celtic, of what Celtic tradition might have been like, or and certainly get a better sense of the practice of it, is when we come later on into the Romano-British period. Because they wrote things down. But this is a, so when we look at these, a lot of the writings around the baths at Sulis Minerva, or we can look at the great Apollo temple that's just up the road in Nettleton, or we can look at the place where the martyrs are found in Cirencester. We get a sense really of a kind of a fusion of Roman religion and Celtic religion. So if we look at Sulis Minerva in particular, so we have this image of this ancient Celtic goddess who is the goddess of the springs. And we have this myth of the King Bladud, who is a swineherd, who has leprosy and who is led by his pig into this kind of muddy pool, really, with hot muddy pool. And by bathing in it, is cured of leprosy. And then there's legends about Bladud, about him becoming a sacred king and becoming one of the kind of tutelary spirits of Bath. Now, this is the Bladud legend points us in the direction of the early Celtic goddess Sulis, who is the goddess of life coming out of the ground, hot healing water. Now she gets married to the figure of Minerva, to create the composite deity Sulis Minerva. And there's a whole lot of work around working and what arises in that place and differently from other versions of Minerva in other parts of the Roman Empire, is a whole tradition of working with the underworld through water. Putting curse tablets into water, putting prayers into water. Again, we know that to be an ancient Celtic custom. When, for example, when Lyn Cherrig Bach in Anglesey, which is one of the great Druidic strongholds, was dredged, all kinds of treasures came up from the pools, because one of the principles that we can infer about very early Celtic religion. Is it reached into the other world through the earth and through water in particular. And in a way it reaches the stars by looking into the sacred pool. Which in fact makes quite a lot of sense, because if you look into a pool, you're into this place of working with opposites, going up by going down. Right, so this is exactly what Marcus was talking about earlier. So you reach the stars by going down, not by trying to jump off the ground. You go into the descent, and in a certain sense, there's even a kind of, you know, wider astronomical sense of that, because actually up and down doesn't really exist. The planet, the space is around us. We are surrounded by the sphere of stars. And actually, it's in a sense by going into the Earth and through the Earth, you'd find yourself in the field of stars. You know, up doesn't exist in that sense in the most spherical kind of universe. So in the beginning, so if we can think of two strata. We can think of the pre-Roman strata, where we have these images from the Tend and Hallstatt culture, and we can infer from that. There's a really wonderful book, by Philip Myrion Morris. If I can just remember the title of it, who was an amazing sculptor and artist it's called Celtic Vision by John Myrion Morris. And he has really looked at this strata of kind of early imagery, and he's used it in his own work. So if you're interested in that early strata, I'd recommend getting his book and having a look at it. It's because he's really very directly looking into that kind of strata. Then the next strata that we have, in a sense, is the Romano-British. So there we can look at the archaeological stuff, a very easy place to look at there and to get a sense of it is by looking at some of the writings around the excavations in Bath. But also being aware that, you know, Bath is one of the big ones that remained. There was a massive temple of Apollo at a place, a little village called Nettleton. It's about, I don't know, 10 miles up the road, which was an octagonal temple. And what do you have to try and... It's very hard to get our heads around this, that actually Romano-British culture and certainly in those of us who live in the southwest, this was really one of the heartlands of the Romano-British culture, as was further east into Kent, in Sussex. But also part of South Wales as well. This was very organized, right? There were roads, there were villas, there were kind of towns. So you're looking at something that then gets kind of swept away, and so much so that, you know, people forget even and think that the places like Bath were built by giants. But this was a whole period of time where there was something very sophisticated going on. You know, and was a fusion. It wasn't a sort of, you know, Romans ruling. Romans were ruling, but it were not just Romans. A lot of the people who were ruling were Romano-British. So there's a whole kind of territory there that can be looked at as an understanding. And because there's quite a lot of information around some of those places, it can just again give us some insight into that earlier way of looking at things. I suppose the other place that can do that, next strata that comes along really is the Celtic Christian, the very early. So if we look at 5th-6th century stuff as Christianity develops in Britain, the legends of the Celtic saints. There's a lot of them. There's a lot of legendary material, but that starts to give us a kind of sense of part of what happens in Romano, in the transition of Romano-British civilization. What comes in with that is Christianity. And towards the latter end of before the legions leave, there's actually quite a lot of active Christian presence operating in that time. So when we come across somebody like St. Illtyd, you know, he's a Romano-British British figure, Christian figure, but also, of course, very connected to the traditions that have come before him. Now and again, what happens? The Romano British world gets swept aside. The Christian traditions that take its place are so often antagonistic to some of the earlier traditions, and so an awful lot gets lost. So what we end up with are legends, are thoughts and ideas that start to come in, and that come into this Dark Ages kind of consciousness, right, where because what happens at the end of the Roman Empire, as the kind of the invasions of the Saxons and the Jutes and beyond them the Danes and things start to happen, there's a whole kind of period of absence of knowledge at one level, and a whole degree of disorganization that starts to happen. But alongside all of that, and there's of course people remember things. People hang on to things. And there's something really that within all these kind of shifts and changes that happen underneath the radar, whatever is happening politically and socioculturally, there within certain segments, within certain places, things get remembered and passed down. Things get lost in the passing down, but things get preserved as well. One of the things that we do know is that oral memory can reach back a very long way. And one of the things that was there right at the heart of Celtic culture, right at the heart of the Tern, the Ulster, the Druidic culture, is the idea of oral transmission. It's one of the reasons we don't have anything written down. But what we do have is a capacity. One of the things that we know about early culture, and we can know this from anthropological studies also, is that there is an enormous capacity to retain oral information and to pass that down in a way that, while it does get changed, preserves a core of truth, of things that are important. And certainly we do start to see that in the writings of the Welsh bards that starts to emerge. Now, when some of the very earliest material we get comes out of something called the Black Book of Carmarthen. Now, what we get there are poems. And one of the poems, which I'd rather like if I could just find it, is the sighing or the crying out of Merthyn. This is Merthyn's dialogue with his little pig. Now this is prior to the writings of Geoffrey of Monmouth. And this is really tapping into a very early tradition. I can't remember when it is then. Let's see what it says here about it. Yeah, we're talking, I mean, the very earliest of them really, around 12th century, something like that. So, but they're reaching back to the poetic things are reaching back to something kind of much earlier. And this gets systemized really by Geoffrey of Monmouth. But this is it's thought that the poems in the Black Book are a bit older than that. Although dating is a nightmare in this situation, right? Because what you're dating are not the actual material, but the manuscript that it's written in. But so I'll just read you a little bit of the sighs of Merthyn. O little piglet, O happy porker, don't dig about in your sty on the top of the mountain. Forage in the hidden place in Avgoedydd, away from the fierce Rhydderch the generous, the tiller man of the faith. I prophesy, and it is the truth, right up to the mouth of Taradir, that before all the nasties of Britain, all the Welsh shall be lined out. Llywelyn, whose name is from the line of Gwynedd, is the man who will carry the day. Oh, little piglet, we had to go away from the hunters of the halls and all the daring do, lest revenge come upon us, lest we're found out. And if we escape, we'll not mourn in our ranks. I prophesy the coming of the ninth wave, the one and only Snowbeard in the doing of Dyved. A monastery will rear its head, not for the backsliders in the terrain of mountains and monsters. Until Cunnan comes back to defend her, to her dwellings there will be no return. Oh, little piglet, I don't sleep easily for the clangor of grief that afflicts me. For 80 years and 10 have I suffered anguish. I'm pining away. Can Jesus procure for me the protection of the kings in heaven with the best lineage? Of Adam's children, and of a bard sign born, is the one who does not believe in the Lord in the last day. I saw Gwendolai, a powerful king, gathering booty far and wide. Under my red earth is he now, all quiet, like the greatest king of the north, the greatest too in tenderness. Now this is about the great battle of that we find Geoffrey of Monmouth talking about, where he runs away into the woods because his lord Gwendolai and the young men are killed. So this is a very, very kind of early kind of image, and one of the reasons we know it's early as well is he is called a Myrddin. He gets translated into Merlin by Geoffrey of Monmouth, because Myrddin, because he's writing for a Norman French audience in Latin, Myrddin is too close to the French word merde, which means shit. And as a Myrddin is his major hero, he doesn't want a hero called Shitty, so he translates him into Merlin. But what we see in some of the early strata stuff is elusive poetry. And one of the interesting things is that Myrddin is one of the very early figures there. What we also find, also enormous source work, is something called the Triodai Ynys Britain, the triads of the land of Britain. And there's been lots of collections of triads, but the most reliable is one by somebody called Rachel Bromwich, who put, because one of the problems of the triads is that Iolo Morgannwg wrote a load of triads of his own, because he liked the idea of triads, because they're very, and triads are very ancient, right? So this is part of this kind of feature you get when you look at those images, when you get this two becoming one. So triadic thinking. So you get a whole list of triads. For example, three perpetual harmonies of the island of Britain, which is the three, or sometimes called the three circles of song. One is at the island of Avalach, probably Avalon. The second at Caer Geradwig, and the third at Bangor. Three licensed guests at Arthur's courts, and three homeless dissatisfied ones, Cluach the Old, Chermenig, and Helith. Three wild spectres of the island of Britain, the spectre of Banug, the spectre of Edvardgug the Sprightly, the spectre of Melin. Three fettered warbands of the island of Britain, the warband of Cadwallon Longarm, who each one put the fetters of their horses on their own feet while fighting with Sergi the Irishman at the Irishman's Rocks in Mona. And the second, the warband of Rhuallan, son of Urien, when fighting with the Saxons. And the third, the warband of Belin of Clun, when fighting with Edwin at Bryn Edwin in Rhos. Now, the whole idea of the triads is they are mnemonics. They are, each one of the items of each triad will have a story. And that story will have other stories, branching stories upon it. So what, in a certain sense, what the oral storytelling does, oral memory does, is to preserve the cultural integrity of a people. It preserves the memories of the ancestors and of the gods of the tribe. And it preserves it in such a way that retelling it recreates the conditions that enable the ancestors and the gods to become visible and present to the people who hear the stories or the poems. So this is this very ancient idea, really, of the bard or the poet as the recreator, as the prophet of the divine. The whole idea that you find in the 19th century, 18th, 19th century romantic poems, poets of the muse. The muse, which becomes rather sentimentalized and attached to maybe a particular woman or something, is actually the muses in Greek tradition are goddesses. They are who overshadow and speak through. And in a certain sense, in Welsh tradition in particular, what is spoken through is this idea of something that is called awen, which is the breath of inspiration, which it gets associated in Christian tradition with the Holy Ghost, because it is this fiery flowing quality, both like fire and water, coming through somebody to recreate the world. So another place we find, early place we find Welsh tradition revealing itself is something called the Stanzas of the Graves. This is another set of mnemonics which bards would use to remember those things that need remembering, to remember the blessed dead, to remember the gods of the tribe, to remember the history that gives us meaning. We have things like the Stanzas of the Grave. The grave of the son of Osran is in Camlan after many a slaughter. The grave of Bedwyr is in Gachtrevan. The grave of Owen ab Urien in a secluded part of the world under the sod of Llanmorfael. In Aberch that of Rhyddach Hael. After wearing dark brown clothes and red and splendid and riding magnificent steeds with sharp spears, in Llanhelydd is the grave of Owen. But there is no place where we find the grave of Arthur. So again, in the remembrance of the graves, so the Stanzas of the Graves is reminding us of the custom of going to the blessed dead, going to the mounds, the ancient mounds where the dead are found, and communing through the dead with the other world. Now the Stanzas of the Grave really is giving us, it's like a gazetteer saying, look, there are all these powerful beings and this is where they are buried, and here you go if you want to commune with them and get their blessing and get their help in your life. It's a sort of, and so these are the kind of heroes or demigods in the sense of Welsh tradition. Now there are two other major places in Welsh tradition, really, again these are all medieval. Four, if I call it. So we get two works by Geoffrey of Monmouth. One called The History of the Kings of Britain, which is his legendary history of the kings of Britain, and which he claims to have obtained from a bard who has an ancient Welsh book that gives him the ancient history of Britain that he is writing down, and he writes it in Latin, and he writes it for the Norman French audience. Now, one of the kind of curious things that happens really in kind of British culture is the very powerful and strong Anglo-Saxon kind of, which was a dominant culture for a very long time, and gets eclipsed by Norman French culture. And Norman French culture comes out of Brittany, so they think of themselves as Celts. They have a political need to think of themselves as being allied to the Britons. Now, Brittany was Little Britain, and there was always an enormous amount of communication between Wales and Brittany. So one of the things that you see happening in the kind of larger culture of Ireland is that the Celtic ideas, the Arthurian ideas, which Geoffrey of Monmouth is the first person really to articulate, gets to eclipse the Anglo-Saxon ideas. And because the ruling class at that time their most troublesome subjects are the Anglo-Saxons, so they want to identify with the ancient Britons. as because this proves that these are they are the true rulers of the land. So in a certain sense, the kind of Anglo-Saxon English writings, English poetry, English traditions get pushed a bit under. And oddly, they don't really, you find Tolkien in particular really drawing on them very powerfully when he comes to write his Lord of the Rings trilogy. Tolkien loathed Arthurian literature and hated the idea that Arthurian literature was regarded as the kind of the true mythology of Britain. Because he's a specialist in Anglo-Saxon studies, and he wanted to promote the Anglo-Saxon ideas. Now, there's something important in that, which we'll come back to at another time, actually, because one of the effects of Anglo-Saxon tradition and the Anglo-Saxon ancestry being pushed under in this way is it becomes split away from the anima mundi of Britain, and then often comes out in a distorted form, which is often why Anglo-Saxon ideas are connected with far right and far right groups. They draw upon that underbelly of something that has got pushed underneath. But coming back to the main topic again, we'll call now before we break for our tea break. What you then start to see happening really is is in the sort of medieval period is a writing down of much earlier material. Geoffrey Monmouth is being one of the first of them, who writes the Vita Merlini, the history of Merlin. Writes the history of the kings of Britain. These become enormous bestsellers, and Geoffrey is very particularly somebody without whom which the Arthurian legend probably would not have taken off in the way that they did. But what we also see emerging in that medieval period, contemporaneously really, is we find the Mabinogion appears and the Llyfr Taliesin appears. The poems of Taliesin, one of which is the enormously important Prydaenerwen. Now, all of these are very late on, right? So this is but they all, most of them, contain material that is very, very old. So if we're looking at and interested in the Welsh material, again just simplifying this down, if we look at, okay, first of all we start off with the Hallstatt Ten Druidic strata, actual strata. We know almost nothing of, but we can infer some things from partly what things the Romans have said, partly things that are reflected later on. Second strata, Romano-British. Third strata, the Celtic Christian. Fourth strata, medieval, beginnings of medieval writings. Geoffrey of Monmouth, the Black Book of Carmarthen, Stanzas of the Graves, Triads of Britain, Mabinogion, Llyfr Taliesin. So in this medieval period, partly energized by the interest in Arthur, there's an enormous splur. There's an enormous emergence of literature, which, truthfully, and again, and I say enormous, we're not talking mass culture here. You have to remember these are written down manuscripts. So the Mabinogion, for example, is found in two manuscripts: Red Book of Hergus, the White Book of Rhydderch. Called red and white because just how they were built, that's the colour of their covers. Black Book of Carmarthen, cover was black. Although very strangely and archetypally, given that black and white and red are the ancient colours of the goddess, it was a strange, that isn't why they're called that, but oddly and mythically, these three great books kind of reflect at least archetypally reflect the ancient colours of the goddess and the alchemical colours as well. Now, when we look at the story, the Llyfr Taliesin, we've got all kinds of stuff, some of which we understand, some of which we don't. There is a fusion there of Christian and much more ancient traditions. Now, if you're very fascinated by the figure of Taliesin, you can get into all the poems, but if you're not, and if you're interested in that territory, read Prithyanovin. And in particular, if you can get hold of, there's still copies of this going on, if you're going to get hold of the text by John and Caitlin Matthews called King Arthur's Raid on the Underworld, what I'm holding up right now. The King Arthur's Raid on the Underworld really is a book that certainly those who studied this with me in a previous class, you'll all have copies of it, but those of you who don't, I really recommend if you want to understand just something about Taliesin and the traditions around without immersing yourself in masses of literature, I would get this book and have a look at it. It's because in a sense Prithyanovin condenses so many of the themes that you find in that kind of bardic tradition. And John and Katie have done quite a good job of unpacking some of them. But actually, one of the ways of working with these ideas is to take the Latin way of looking at an object and look at the poems, look at the triads, look at the stanzas of the great, and allow that to affect you so that something new emerges. Dai seems to be wheeling a wheelbarrow in the background. I die. Sorry, I got completely distracted. That's funny. Anyway, what was I talking about? Yes, okay. I'll come to the Mabinogion first, which is the place that... I love the Mabinogion, but everybody talks about the Mabinogion when they talk about connecting to Welsh tradition. And people talk about the Mabinogion as though it is the holy book. It is one of many, one of a number anyway. So lots of amazing stuff in it. I love the Mabinogion. But one of the things that it is not is a description of ancient Welsh deities. The four branches of the Mabinogion are the retelling of ancient stories in a new form, in a medieval form. They're interlinked, it holds within, the great benefit of the Mabinogion, it holds within its writing style, within its construction, the poetic ways of writing and kenning and understanding. The four branches in particular have an internal coherence and an external incoherence. They are telling one story in four different ways. And one of the things that happened with the kind of pagan revival stuff is that these figures, who are at the very least are demigod figures, ancestral figures, or figures that are used to demonstrate points, partly they have some elements of ancient deities about them, but they're kind of organized together in people's minds as though this is a sort of a pantheon of deities that people believed in and used to worship. Nobody ever worshipped Gwydion, son of Don. Right? Gwydion, son of Don, is an extraordinary figure, a magician figure. And certainly he will have been contemplated, he will have been seen as an archetypal magician, as a great magician, as a great ancestor of the past. He will never have been a god figure. You know, the things that we do know about ancient Celtic gods and goddesses, none of them are ever called any of the Welsh names. It's not a book that says, this is not a book of ancient Welsh religion. It is a book of ancient Welsh poetry and use of the bardic imagination, which connects us up to the root of the tradition. And one of the reasons for labouring this whole point around this particular path that's between Yesod and Tiferet is that, above all, what we need is this poetic capacity to work with opposites in conjunction. to look at an object like the Laten, like the Laten images, and allow ourselves to become one with it. To read a strange story, let me just find, there's a very particular, amazing story in the Mabinogion, isn't part of the Four Branches. It's called Kilhuch, the story of Kilhuch and Olwen. The word Kilhuch means the boy who was born in a pig pen, and who is the son of Golaidith. And Golaidith's name is the son of the bright... Golaidith means the bright light of the day. So Kilhuch is the son of light, the son of the bright light of the day. And the... he has a wicked stepmother, and his stepmother... his mother dies, the light dies in that sense, and he has a stepmother who swears a geser, swears an oath upon him that he will have no wife unless he can marry Olwen, the daughter of Anasbaddon, chief giant, who is notorious for killing and eating the suitors of Olwen. And we get this rather amazing, and so he goes off to, he's a cousin of Arthur, it's a very early Arthurian story, and he goes off to Arthur's court to get some help in this quest for Olwen. Olwen is also the daughter of light. She is the daughter, where her name Olwen means white track, because wherever she walks, white flowers emerge from the soil. So these are two very ancient figures, the son of light, the daughter of light. Very, very ancient in Welsh tradition. But here we find in this medieval story a very beautiful description of the Son of Light. The boy went off on a steed with a gleaming grey head, 4 winters old, well jointed stride, shell-like hooves, and a tubular gold bridle bit in his mouth, with a precious gold saddle beneath him and 2 sharp spears of silver in his hand. He had a battle axe in his hand the length of the forearm of a full-grown man from ridge to edge. It would draw blood from the wind. It would be swifter than the swiftest dewdrop from the stalk to the ground, when the dew is heaviest in the month of June. He had a gold-hinted sword on his thigh, and its blade of gold, with a gold-chased shield the colour of heaven's lightning, and its rim is of ivory. And there were 2 spotted white-breasted greyhounds in front of him, with a collar of red gold around the neck of each from shoulder swell to ear. The one on the left side would run to the right side. The one on the right side would run to the left side, like 2 sea swallows swooping around him. His steed's 4 hooves would cut out 4 clods, like 4 swallows in the air, above him, sometimes in front of him, sometimes behind him. He had a purple 4-cornered cloak about him, with a ruby gold ball at each corner. Each ball was worth 100 cows. The precious gold in his buskins and stirrups, from the top of his thigh to the tip of his toe, was worth 300 cows. Not even the tip of a hair on him stirred, so light was the steed's canter beneath him on his way to the gate of Arthur's court. Now we've got this extraordinary image of this man on a white horse carrying, gleaming with gold, with spears of silver, greyhound interlacing back before him, and this enormous sense of vertical movement, of clods jumping forward behind him. So we get and who is somehow riding almost above the ground, nothing stirs upon him. He is moving and he is still. So we get this very, you know, we're being presented with this very ancient image of the Son of Light. And further down, let me just see if I can find Olwen. Yeah, so we get a description of Olwen. She comes with a robe of flame-red silk about her, and a torque of red gold about the maiden's neck, with precious pearls and red jewels. Yellower was her hair than the flowers of the broom, whiter was her flesh than the foam of the wave. Whiter were her palms and her fingers than moist cotton grass amidst the fine gravel of a bubbling spring. Neither the eye of a mewed hawk nor the eye of a thrice-mewed falcon, no eye was fairer than hers. Whiter were her breasts than the breast of a white swan. Redder were her cheeks than the reddest foxglove. Whoever saw her would be filled for love of her. Four white clovers would spring up behind her wherever she went, and for that reason she was called Olwen. So again, we've got this very beautiful, very powerful, very numinous kind of image. And there's all so much in this story, but including one of the very few stories we have about the hunting of Mabon and Modron. You know, this particular story contains enormous amounts of Welsh tradition. A part of and one of the whole there's a whole segment of it of the naming of the men and women of Arthur's court, each one of which will have had their own story. Now, the importance of these stories, the importance of remembering them, of reading them, is not so that we even rediscover what they thought and meant, but the images spark off in us new creativity, new life. Which is, and in a certain sense, you know, this is not a book of sermons. It is a book of poetry. It is a book of inspiration that is designed to help us make the break from the world of the lower triangle of the tree into the middle triangle of the tree, into the place where we can be the alchemist who can combine opposites. Now, this whole kind of strata kind of continues in Welsh tradition. So this is a particular kind of emergence and flowering. But a couple of centuries later, we find the figure of Dafydd ap Gwilym. Great poet, but great lover, great poet, but also misunderstood often, because actually what you find Dafydd writing poems about women, that he's operating within the kind of within the European context of Dante. So the women he writes poems about are aspects of the goddess, aspects of the divine feminine. And one of the things you find him often in the greenwood, and he often has his poems are addressed to animals, and the animals send messages between him and his beloved. And this is that very ancient image, really, of the kind of totem animals coming out of the forest, bringing the message of the divine and community, bringing us to the divine. So what you see happening is underneath the radar, without it having to be explicitly religious, you see an underneath thread of the transmission of these ideas, not through a priesthood, not through theology, but through the continual inspiration of the imagination. And even to our day, you find it, you know, sort of Marcus's remembrance of Dylan Thomas and the Chained in the Sea. You know, so Dylan, who makes very few at all references to Welsh tradition, is completely within this tradition. And in a certain sense, you find these stories retelling themselves. And the importance of them is that they connect us up to a different way of thinking and being. Now, if you're like me and John Matthews and like one Penny Billington of this group, who are really fascinated by these things, we read this stuff all the time because we enjoy it, because we like it. But it isn't that you have to do that. But if you're interested in it, select one or two things. And not because you want to become expert in Welsh tradition or Brythonic tradition or anything like that, but because it will give you an understanding of a different way of thinking and being. And one of the ways it will do that is that it will disarrange you. It will disarrange your normal ways of thinking. Find it quite irritating. But you might also It's just if it's irritating, well, close it and don't do anything with it. But normally you find a sort of inspiration and an irritation. And it's the inspiration that kind of gets you persevering with something. And in a certain sense, you can take any, you could just even take one triad alone, actually. If we take the triad of the three things called the destruction of Logres, the receiving of strangers, the freeing of prisoners, the gift of the bald man. If you hang out with that and reflect on that and listen to that and work with that, there's a whole world that can emerge out of that. Because if we come right back to the original images and the interconnectedness of all those original Hallstatt images, any one piece connects to every other piece. And so the key thing in a certain sense is to take just one little hem of the garment, one little bit that appeals. It doesn't have to be any of this stuff. It could be other things. Could be Scottish border ballads, for example, of another example. Anything that connects us up to this different way of using the imagination. Normally, the stuff we have to find is pre-18th century. Because what we start to see from the 18th century, and that's partly why some of the Druidry revival stuff is both interesting and doesn't have this kind of energy of creativity in the revivalist stuff, because actually it's become too contaminated with linear thinking. In the medieval times, even the 16th century times, that desire to kind of encapsulate and to over describe and over organize isn't there. So the way in which you can use this material to bring yourself into a different way of thinking and experiencing your world is kind of really important at one level. And the other thing it does is help you understand the different layers of experience that the collective soul of this country has gone through. And that the other thing that, of course, you discover when we touch this material, that the dead are still alive. The ancestors are alive within us and around us. The land speaks back to us. We're in the world of Alice in Wonderland. Right? Things talk back if we're prepared to talk to them. If we're prepared to listen to them. If we're not, of course they don't, and then we just live in a dead universe. But in a way, that's the difference between looking at that lower sphere, lower triangle of the Tree of Life, which is encapsulated within the internal dialogue, which allows no new life in, as opposed to opening that up into the middle triangle of the tree, where actually everything becomes much more alive and much more uncertain. Let me just stop there because we're running into tea time. So let's just stop and come back at 4 o'clock, and we'll then start to bring all this together a bit.